KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture, the inaugural spring quarter 2015 edition of the show. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and this year, a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Today, I'm very excited to have on a repeat guest coming back after several years of not being on the show to discuss her fascinating, relatively new book, Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Our guest is Professor Danielle Citron of the University of Maryland School of Law, and she's written what has already, I think, become the seminal book on the question of how the internet has created both new hate crimes as well as exacerbated existing ones. Anyone who, and that would include virtually all Hearsay Culture listeners, by virtue of listening via podcast, you have internet access and you use that internet. And so you are fully aware of the fact that people both say and do things on the internet that they may not be doing in private life, they may not do physically, they may not do in person. And so the internet has become not only a wonderful medium for information sharing and accessing information, which really was the genesis of Hearsay Culture, but unfortunately it's also become a wonderful platform to go after people in ways that are pernicious and vicious and crimes that heretofore had not existed, or at least were not as easy to do. In Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, Danielle, who's written extensively on this topic and also written wonderful articles and really groundbreaking articles on civil rights and due process on the internet, focuses on two primary questions. First, understanding what cyber crimes are, and particularly what cyber harassment is. And then secondly, different critiques and criticisms of regulating these issues and including a policy proposal for how to deal with it. In the book, Danielle has written what I think is not only very well researched, but really a very balanced view of this issue. Because when you think about cyber crime and cyber harassment and cyber bullying, you're dealing with an issue which superficially seems fairly straightforward. Generally speaking, we don't want people going after other people in ways that cause emotional distress, that could be torts or some other type of civil crime or civil remedy, or in fact could be something that raises or rises to the level of a crime. However, there are important considerations on the other side, particularly when you consider that these activities fall as speech. And so there has been concern raised by organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union and others suggesting that when we attempt to regulate speech, and of course this is constitutional law that goes back a couple of hundred years in the United States, you run into questions of quashing the rights of people to express themselves. And so we're going to spend some time today on the show not just discussing the range of this problem and Danielle's research and experience with it, not just Danielle's policy proposals, which I think are very fascinating and forward-thinking, but also we'll consider some of these critiques, including speech, and also what is considered by many to be a very successful and paradigmatic internet law, the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, and its shield for speech liability, like defamation claims, for the platforms, for the internet access providers, so that you cannot, at least in the United States, sue an entity like Facebook for the speech of one of its customers, so long as, generally speaking, Facebook doesn't become the speaker itself. We're going to deal with all of these issues on the show and going through the book, and I'm very excited to have Danielle on the show. By way of background, she is a professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law, who focuses on information privacy, cyber law, automated systems, and civil rights. She's also won teaching awards. Aside from Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, which was published last year by Harvard University Press, she's also written law review articles in a number of top journals, on issues involving not just cybercrime, but as I mentioned earlier, due process on the internet. And she also wrote a really fascinating article with another Hearsay Culture favorite guest Frank Pasquale on fusion centers and the aggregation of data for purposes of going after criminals, which was fairly early work, even though it only goes back about 5 or 6 years in a space which is now obviously exploded post Snowden and NSA. She is an affiliate fellow at Yale's Information Society Project, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Stanford Center for Internet Society, which I guess is a bit of a disclaimer or caveat, although on Hearsay Culture I regularly have people that are affiliated with Stanford, and I'm always excited to talk to interesting people regardless of the affiliation, but it's an extra bonus when I can talk to Stanford folks. She's testified at the House of Commons before the Interparliamentary Coalition for Combating Anti-Semitism, and she's also spoken extensively internationally on issues of hate. We are recording this show on April 2nd, 2015, and Danielle is joining us via Skype from her office at the University of Maryland. Danielle, thank you so much for coming back on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back, considering I listen to your show all of the time, often in my most fun moments, like cooking in the kitchen. Well, so it's great to be back on.
Thank you so much, Danielle, and it's always gratifying for me to hear from listeners, particularly when those listeners are also wonderful guests. So it's wonderful to have you here. You were on the show several years ago talking about some of that earlier work, but for those people that haven't kept up, tell us a bit more about your background and why you wrote this book now.
Right. So I've been writing about or thinking about online harassment since 2007. When we saw sort of simultaneously in the spring attacks on the technologist Kathy Sierra, as well as sort of targeted attacks of female law students on a message board called AutoAdmit. And at the time, you know, I write about privacy, and what I sort of came to understand both of the experiences that I saw sort of happening and also being trivialized was that we very much were seeing the same pattern, very sexually humiliating, sexually threatening comments that really were designed to chase people offline and silence them and to destroy their online reputations and to expose them in very humiliating and privacy-invading ways. And we saw in both of their cases, or both instances, sort of cyber mobs that were targeting like pretty vulnerable people and then making their lives miserable, putting them at risk for physical attack. And it made me think of, as well as like reputational and economic harm and sort of just the harm of the ability to interact online, And I came to understand the problem, at least in the way that we once saw kind of anonymous cyber mobs target vulnerable people, you know, in the, certainly over the ages in the United States. You know, it's no surprise that our civil rights history grows out of anonymous mobs targeting blacks, that I, in some respects, we saw sort of anonymous mobs using anonymity and to hide behind anonymity to perpetrate really like horrendous wrongs. They weren't involving physical attack, much like the civil rights problems of another era, but they were having a devastating impact, and they seemed designed to sort of economically, socially, and politically intimidate and chase people from what they love to do. So that's how I got, you know, that was kind of my way in, and then I just haven't stopped writing about it.
I was going to say, you know, it's one of those issues where it's hard to know where to begin with approaching a topic that seems, you know, initially like something we've been dealing with forever, right? People have been bullying and harassing and hurting each other since time immemorial. With that in mind, I wanted to find some terms, but before I do that, who is the audience that you envisioned for this book? I mean, if you're thinking about who you're writing for, who are they?
You know, I really wrote for a general audience, and including in that general audience, not just college students, you know, and young people who were sort of at the cusp of using network tools to make a living, right? But also, of course, policymakers. And it's been really gratifying to have folks like the Attorney General of California, who I'm now working with, contact me and said, you know, we've seen your book, we want you to come talk to our office about it, and have that kind of impact, not only, and companies too. So I'll be speaking at Google, I'm going to be at Microsoft in a few weeks, so that my pitch really was a general audience book, not just law professors, but folks who could make a difference on the ground, whether it's, you know, chief privacy officers or content policy officers at big companies, as well as lawmakers and policymakers, law enforcement officers. It's very much a conversation for them, for all of us, for parents and schools, I think, because we could all do something about this problem. And it's not going to take just one set of actors, but really like a targeted attack from so many different sort of parts of the way in which we live our lives. So it's not just law, but non-legal actors, companies, parents, schools, kind of all of us, in order to tackle this problem.
It's interesting that you mentioned, Danielle, since you brought it up, that Google and Microsoft are talking to you. Have they given you a sense of what it is that they want you to talk about? Is it generally we want to learn more about these issues? Or do they have particular concerns in mind? Because as I mentioned in my introduction, of course, entities like Google and Microsoft are literally at the nexus of this problem because they are both platforms, and in that sense, they can be viewed as enablers. But as you just mentioned, they are also capable of regulating this behavior. So have you gotten a sense, or if you're at liberty to say, about what they're interested in hearing about?
So I think in some respects I can. Their interest is, and I can also speak about other companies I've been helping and thinking through the problems of non-consensual pornography or the posting of nude photos without someone's consent. And I think we've seen all of these companies that have social platforms. They have already terms of service and community guidelines in which they are coming to ban harassment, stalking, threats, and non-consensual pornography. And Google is no stranger. I mean, they've long banned nudity on their social platforms like Blogger. And they have pretty clear terms of service and community guidelines. Same is true for Facebook, who I've worked with for a number of years, just in talking and through some of my work on the Anti-Cyber Hate Task Force. Microsoft's Xbox team does, I think, a magnificent job trying to make their community safe for users, right? So that we already see with many social platforms, and increasingly so, like Twitter and Reddit and Facebook that recently sort of announced their policy change in banning non-consensual pornography. I mean, a lot of these companies on their social platforms have already taken a pretty active role, best they can, to address harassment, stalking and threats. I think they can always do better, and so a lot of my thinking, I think, will be helpful to them, I hope, and they've told me, ways to do what they do better. That is, be clear about what they mean by the terms harassment, stalking, threats, non-consensual pornography. Work on ways in which they can really improve their reporting process and make it scalable. Strategies for being clear and transparent, very much like a due process approach, to what happens when content breaks those rules, right? What does the company do? Does it let users know? If it removes speech, make sure it tells users it's doing so. Is there a possibility for redress and challenge? So that's some of the stuff I'm going to be talking about with them. Presenting my book, but also, hopefully talking about ways in which I think we can make some of their processes that are already sort of baked into some of their architecture and their policies more efficient and transparent.
We're chatting with Professor Danielle Citron, author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, Danielle, I want to come back to, because that's really interesting, what intermediaries can and cannot do, or what they should be doing from your perspective on these issues. But before we get there, let's define a few terms. And of course, this is the lawyerly part of the show where I'm asking for definitions. But, cyber harassment sounds perhaps like we could just figure out what it is. But when you're dealing with a body of, and we can talk about the specific laws before we go broader, when you've got harassment versus bullying and you go down that path and stalking, there is some degree of overlap and then some degree of not. So what is cyber harassment, for starters? How do we understand that?
Right. And I think you're absolutely right. It's incredibly important before we study, before we talk about and respond to online harassment and stalking, that we got to define it. Because it is what seems like an amorphous term actually is not that amorphous. So that I'm going to treat cyber harassment and cyber stalking as sort of one concept. And then importantly, beyond like a bare bones definition, explain how it's perpetrated. Because that's the most, I think, that'll help give dimension to the bare, the bare definition. But a definition of it, and which I'm borrowing from criminal law, is a persistent course of conduct that's aimed at a particular person that is designed to and that causes substantial emotional distress, and often the fear of physical harm. But of course, that just gets us started. Important to understand is how it's perpetrated. And it's perpetrated in four central ways. The first is really an effort by harassers to terrorize people, either with threats of violence or by impersonations that sort of pretend that you are someone and then suggest an interest in sex and provide someone's home address, which is terrifying for victims for fear that they're going to be confronted offline. The second mode of attack is really to go after someone's reputation and post defamatory lies about them online, and then manipulate search engines to ensure that those lies are prominent in searches of someone's name. The third kind of mode of attack is an invasion of privacy. You know, we often see harassers post people's nude photos in violation of their trust or confidence, or having stolen them, hacked into the computers, stolen them, and then post them online, often with identifying information. And the last is to use technology to basically shove people offline. So a denial of service, distributed denial of service attack, right, that's designed to basically force websites to close intermittently. We often see not only these technological attacks, but all of these modes of attack are often a perfect storm of abuse. So it's not just the sexually humiliating threat or sexually threatening, you know, remark like I'm going to rape you, but often in combination with the accusation that someone has herpes, along with their nude photos. And efforts to shut them or shove them offline. And that's what abuse I'm talking about, right? Cyber stalking and cyber harassment, not, as you mentioned, Dave, bullying, which really is something I think we define quite differently, and we're addressing a much younger audience, right? Which often involves, I think, very different legal issues and different legal actors. It's not to say that harassment and stalking can involve kids who are under, you know, under the under 18 set, but I want to talk about ways in which we're seeing adults targeted that make it impossible for them to work, to really to walk about and do their, you know, live their lives without a fear of safety, and to really get a job, make a living, and to speak and engage online without this kind of abuse.
And so if we're drawing the distinction, or at least you're drawing the distinction, Danielle, between cyber harassment and cyber stalking and cyber bullying, what would be the policy rationale for drawing that line? I mean, I understand that you're dealing with children versus adults, what would the reasons be to treat them differently, not only in terms of theorizing what's going on, but because of the fact that we are still writing the policies and understanding what the implications of those are? Where is that line drawn, and why should it be drawn there?
Right. So schools and state lawmakers define cyberbullying to encompass bullying in schoolyards. So the sort of well-accepted understanding of what bullying is could be, of course, in person as well as using network tools. But it specifically is defined to encompass children who are attacking each other, and very much with the locus of the destruction is on campus, like, you know, with either elementary, middle, or high school. So I make this decision because in some respects policymakers have, and I think it makes sense for me to depart, you know, to sort of sever the discussion, because the harassment and stalking that I'm talking about is centered so much on the economic consequences to people's lives, that when you Google search a job candidate's name, the lies, privacy invasions, and threats that appear really hijack their ability to make a living, right? It's jobs they don't get, and jobs they never got an interview for. So that bullying just doesn't encompass that kind of risk. So it's not that I don't want to ever talk about cyberbullying. It's just that the kinds of policy choices and actors who are at the table discussing it are really different, right? We're not talking about employers. We're not talking about the sort of adult consequences that bullying, it's not that it doesn't end in really tragic circumstances, right? We've seen kids commit suicide as a result of bullying that occurs on and off campus. But I want to center the problem, which unfortunately is a significant problem, on stalking and harassment.
So, Danielle, we have the general definitions, but then as you talk about in the book at length, the ability of the internet and really of technology to scale this behavior and to make it more sophisticated and more targeted exacerbates this basic policy problem that's existed, like I said, for a long time. And so you use phrases like stalking by proxy and group cyber stalking, right. which and you use them early on, and they run as a thread of the kinds of behaviors that you're concerned about throughout the book. So what is stalking by proxy and group cyber stalking, and how does that suggest the power of technology to exacerbate these problems?
That's right. I mean, so I'm going to weave the definition of those things into your kind of astute segue into the dynamics of online tools, right? And the ways in which network tools can magnify harm, right? So that, you know, we often say that network tools, have so much positive potential, but the negative potential that they have is that they bring us close together with people who are geographically dispersed from us and allow us to kind of coordinate activities with these geographically dispersed players in ways that we would never have been able to, at least given costs, right, and geographical boundaries. Allow us to coordinate with people we don't know to wreak either really great things or really destructive things. And that's where, so let's loop back into stalking by proxy. I think what the definition is, and group stalking for both, is really the idea that people coordinate their activities with others. Stalking by proxy means you basically have other people do your dirty work. So let's take the impersonator, someone who impersonates someone in a sex ad and says they're interested in sex and available for rape fantasies and please come do X, Y, and Z to me, the harasser puts online. What that can constitute stalking by proxy, because all of the strangers who then contact the victim and demand sex, and I'll give you an example just to have this come alive for you but and to your listeners, but all of the people who contact the victim unwittingly are part of their stalking the victim at the behest of someone else, and they really don't even realize it in many cases, right? Mm-hmm. It's also true that we have seen and do see groups stalk individuals, that it may be one person who kind of sparks the fire, but other people sort of jump on the bandwagon, and it is made so much easier because they may not be in a room together, right? They may be looking at different, let's say, message boards at very different times, but they can coordinate their activities and make it far worse for someone, right? And they often will move to extremes because they want to one-up each other, right? You see someone say something pretty destructive and you say, I'm going to one-up you, right? I'm going to say something even more destructive, and it becomes this kind of game, right? So I think an example can help illustrate the problem, mm-hmm. right? Let's think about Anita Sarkeesian, right? So she's a media critic who 2 years ago announced that she was going to fund or was starting a campaign on Kickstarter to fund a documentary about sexism in video games. And within a week of her announcing her effort, a cyber mob descends. She receives countless of emails and texts, as well as Twitter comments, that basically brutal emails and texts that say that people are going to rape her. Like, bitch, I'm coming for you. And I know where you live. Graphic rape threats. At the same time, if you look online, you can Google it today. There's a game called Beat Up Anita Sarkeesian. And any key that you press in your computer will make a depiction of her face. She's a very beautiful, striking woman. So you see her distinct face. It gets increasingly bloodied and purple, right? And at the same time, there were kind of online hubs of people coordinating false campaign of disinformation. So the Kickstarter received hundreds of false complaints about Anita's campaign on Kickstarter that called it a fraud. And her YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter accounts were falsely reported as hate speech, is the irony, hate speech spam and terroristic speech, right? And the effort was to shove her offline, right? And her website, Feminist Frequency, was hit with distributed denial of service attacks. And it was intermittently sort of shoved on and offline. And it really kind of, it went on for 2 years' time, but really reached, I would say, a fever pitch over the summer with the so-called sort of Gamergate controversy. Mm-hmm. She began again receiving sort of a torrent of emails from anonymous individuals who made even more specific rape threats, and this time with her home address and her parents' home address. She was supposed to give a talk at Utah State, and the dean's office received phone calls, anonymous phone calls, an email saying, if you let Anita Sarkeesian speak at your school, there will be a school shooting worse than Newtown or Columbine, right? Mm. So, I mean, this is a group. So, Dave, you asked about group cyberstalking, right, and sort of stalking by proxy. I mean, this to me is a terrific illustration of group stalking, right? People who are egging each other on. It's countless individuals. As Anita said, what am I supposed to say to the police? It's like thousands of people. I have no idea who it is. It's clearly not the work of one person. It couldn't be. It would take far too much time for one person, right? I'm receiving simultaneous emails and texts, mm-hmm, from hundreds of people, right? And the sort of stalking by proxy is often something we see in revenge porn cases, where a harasser will put up fake ads on adult sort of dating sites, and next to a victim's nude photos and often sort of sexually explicit videos, and suggest that they're the victim and that the victim is interested in anonymous sex. And what happens is the victim is then overwhelmed with, you know, emails, texts, and often physical, and it can be actual confrontation offline by strangers who say, I saw your ad, I'm interested in sex, you're hot, are you interested? And that's stalking by proxy. And you can get countless people to do your bidding, right, with those kind of impersonating ads. So I hope that illustrates, you know, some of why these network tools can really do great damage, because we can just get so many people engaged in the destructive effort.
We're chatting with Professor Danielle Citron of the University of Maryland School of Law, author of the book Hate Crimes in Cyberspace on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. So Danielle, I think you've brought into frightening and stark relief, you know, what these activities look like and what the harms are. One last definitional question, which I appreciate you taking, is that you're separating out revenge porn, it seems, as something a little bit different than even cyber stalking and cyber harassment. And I'm curious about that, only to the extent that, people are putting, you know, images which are obviously by definition private and by definition pornographic on the internet for purposes of, again, harassment or stalking. Should that and this is a segue into what the law is now. Should that kind of particular activity be treated differently than the stalking and harassment that doesn't involve pornography?
Right. So actually, I'm not treating them differently. Okay. They're often, stalking and harassment is often perpetrated in part by the posting of nude photos without someone's consent, and often in violation of their sort of trust and confidence. Mm-hmm. But the reason why we, I think, should define what we mean by non-consensual pornography, in part because it helps companies figure out the kinds of activities that they prohibit, but also because it's true, you can put up one nude photo of someone next to their often identifying details, and it can cause massive harm. So a single photo that appears prominently in a search of someone's name can cause all of the, you know, inspire strangers to contact the person. It can lead to a lost job and have the kind of reputational consequences, even though it's just one photo. It would never be understood as harassment or stalking because it wouldn't constitute a repeated, persistent course of conduct designed to cause emotional distress and or the fear of physical harm. So that, stalking and harassment only exist if you have sustained, repeated behaviors attacking individuals, not the one-off post. But we know that a nude photo posted with identifying information in violation of someone's confidence is fundamentally an invasion of sexual privacy that can do tremendous damage. And so I think lawmakers rightfully have thought about criminalizing those kinds of very specific invasions of sexual privacy because stalking and harassment laws may not reach them, right? In part because their stalking and harassment laws need to be reformed, and in part because it may just be a single one or two photo, not a persistent course of conduct.
And so we're in an era now, as you know, in 2015, where we have very active state legislatures going in all kinds of directions that focus on speech and focus on behaviors. And much of that legislation is uncontroversial. Some of it, and we're recording on April 2nd, 2015, and so, you know, right now, and I'm not asking about it, but to contextualize, we have the bill that has been signed by the governor in Indiana, which purports to be about religious freedom, but which has already seen to be used to prevent gays and lesbians from having the ability to go into businesses that they previously went to. Point is, right, we've got very active legislatures, and I want to talk about the law as it exists, the specific law, and then the broader law. But before we go there, I want to ask a trickier question, which is a hard question. Do you have confidence, as it stands today, in our political system to deal with, right, this problem in a measured sense? Now, of course, I'm not asking you to do a state-by-state survey, but our political process being what it is, the influx of money, interest groups, and the like, this would seem to me, right, to be a somewhat or largely non-controversial area, in the sense that most people can agree that this is behavior that we don't want to have happen, right? And then the debate becomes how to deal with it. So what's your sense, before we talk about the law itself, what's your sense of the political process and these questions?
Right. So I think we should focus on the state legal sort of apparatus, because at least I'm not bullish about change at the federal level, and frankly, we don't need it, right? We have well-designed, well-tailored federal cyber stalking and harassment laws and threat laws. So in so many respects, the criminal law at the federal level is aspirational for the states. And of course, it's tough to enforce. I mean, it's incredibly expensive for the FBI to pursue any case, and they often just don't prioritize harassment and stalking. Some do, like Central District of California, the U.S. Attorney's Office is fantastic and incredible prosecutors, but that's not, you know, every assistant, you know, every U.S. Attorney's Office across the country. So I think we're better off certainly looking at the state level where they really need fixing state laws. And your question was more like, do we think this is a good environment for state lawmakers to step in? Will they, as a matter of political reality, will they listen when you give them good advice?
Right.
And are we seeing an opening? And I think we are. We're seeing sort of at the state level an increasing interest, much as you did in the early 1990s. The stalking and harassment laws, at least especially the stalking laws, really began in California in 1990. And within 3 years, you had all 50 states with stalking laws. Now, they met the problems of another era. I mean, many of them required physical to lie in wait, you know, which is very much very physicalized terrorizing of someone. And those laws, like over, I'd say, 40% of the state harassment laws on the books truly are, they're outmoded. They only apply when the harassment and stalking is sent directly to a victim. And so they wouldn't cover abuse on third-party sites. So we certainly are in need of reform. And only 16 states now criminalize non-consensual pornography. So we have a ways to go, right? We have gaps in the law that need filling, or laws that need to be caught up with 21st century technologies, though in a tech-neutral way. Am I hopeful that we're going to see that change? I mean, in part, we've already seen it. We've seen already now 25 states are considering amending and criminalizing invasions of sexual privacy that involve the posting, non-consensual posting of nude photographs. That's a terrific, I think, within the last 16 or 18 months, which is kind of amazing, right? I mean, at least by my lights, having been working in this space for 7 years on this issue and seeing no progress, writing as much as I can, and really, literally, like, the silence was deafening. But, you know, ever since, you know, we had this convergence of Gamergate and Jennifer Lawrence's posting of her nude photos and the hack of iCloud. You know, Amanda Hess's brilliant article in Pacific Standard. You had, like, in the last year and a half, I think, a raised consciousness that's had an impact on the state level. Now, can we always trust state lawmakers to get it right? We can't, right? So, you know, work that the ACLU and I did in Maryland was we helped draft a first draft of the revenge porn law in Maryland together. and one in which I would testify on behalf of the bill and the ACLU was going to back off. But when the bill came out of committee, it didn't help. It didn't solve either of our problems, right? Mm-hmm. It was both too broad for the liking of the ACLU and mine, and too narrow. So, you know, is every state for state legislature going to do the right thing? Or are there going to be political bargains in committee where when the sausage is made, it's just not terrific? I can tell you that from experience, we're going to see some mistakes and missteps, but we can fix them, right? So I have students who now are state lawmakers in Maryland, which is so exciting. And they said to me, we're interested in fixing the bill. Will you help? I said, absolutely. Right. Round two. I'm ready. So I guess I am bullish. Like, I'm bullish on the idea of reform. And, you know, the AG of California has been front and center on work, getting her hands around the problem of the exploitation of nude photos without consent and bringing together companies and law enforcement. And advocates at the table to see how we can better educate law enforcement at the state level, how companies can make a difference. I mean, we saw the kind of new proposals and policies from Twitter and Reddit after the AG had her convening, at which I spoke in November. So I'm really heartened by all of that intersecting activity at the state level.
Danielle Citron, the author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace on KJFFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Let me ask you this, Danielle. Coming back to, you know, this change, and you mentioned a couple of incidents here, and I just want to be clear about it. So what about those particular incidents in that article do you think caused this awakening? I mean, is it that they were a high profile and therefore they got a lot of attention, or was there something about those particular stories or the harms or activities that you think cause people to take notice?
And you're thinking about when I talked about Amanda Hess's piece in Pacific Standard.
Okay. Yes, and Jennifer Lawrence and Gamergate.
Yeah. No, I think really good question, right? Like, let's drill down. How has this sea change really happened and why? So Amanda writes for Slate, and she wrote about her own personal experience about being threatened on Twitter, very graphic, leaving nothing to the imagination threats on Twitter that were terrifying. And she called the police. So she tells the story. She tells her story in the article about calling local police in California at the time she lived in California. And the response was, what's Twitter? What's the big deal? Just shut down your account, right? Stop making a fuss over this, right? And she's a journalist. Twitter is indispensable to the work that she does. She couldn't just go offline. It's not an option for the work that she does, right? Is it really an option for anyone in the 21st century trying to make a living? Of course it's not, right?
Right.
And Amanda tells her story in a really affecting way. And she talked about, and we had talked extensively before she wrote it, about the possibility of a civil rights agenda. And it captured people's attention. So the New York Times editorial board wrote about the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, which is run by Holly Jacobs, a victim who so bravely came forward after her sort of terrible experience and changing her name and real silencing. And then we saw, I'd say about 6 or 7 months later, the sort of increasing attacks on women in gaming, which it's true there, you know, lots of very prominent people were involved. So Brianna Wu, Anita Sarkeesian, increasingly prominent, Zoe Quinn, and other women in gaming started coming forward and talking about the kind of devastating rape threats they were receiving. And then you had the tipping point, which was Jennifer Lawrence's piece in Vanity Fair, in which she talked about the theft of her nude photos in the iCloud sort of, I guess, hack. And then posting online and viral spread of that online, including at the Fappening, which was a subreddit. And her saying, look, this is an invasion of my sexual privacy. I'm humiliated and I shouldn't be, right? I shared this with someone I cared about. It was only for his eyes. I got hacked. And now I'm being shamed. And this is unacceptable. And I shouldn't be shamed for being a young woman in love. And she's absolutely right. There is nothing wrong with sharing intimate photos with someone you care about, right? And to be pilloried and deemed a slut and shamed is unacceptable. And I think her saying that with the kind of, for she has such a pluckiness and sort of appeal for the young and the old, you know, she's such a gifted actress, that I think people started listening. I know the AG of California was in touch with her. You know, I think she made a huge impact on the public as a whole. And it brought all these things together.
And I'm wondering too, because what you know, we've mentioned a number of women who have been victims here, but as you point out in a book, men also become Absolutely. Victims of this behavior. Although you don't seem to hear about it as much, am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely talk to men who experience it. But what's interesting is that they either said like, "It's not as bad for me because I'm not a woman," you know, like being impersonated and on OkCupid and being suggested that you're interested in anal rape. You know, a male blogger explained, like, yeah, it was pretty scary that he wasn't gay, but it wouldn't even matter, mm-hmm. right? He said, I'm not as afraid of being raped anally, though probably should be, as I am for my female friends. But you do have writers like James Lasden, he's a creative writer and teacher, who wrote a whole book about his stalking experience, in which it's very much sexually humiliating and threatening abuse, but it was a narrative that we took the woman's experience and you turned it upside down. So his stalker, a former student, accused him of raping women, of being a sexual predator, and sent emails to his publisher, his editor, on his Amazon review page for his books, accusing him of raping people, right? So he's like, it's a narrative that's sexually humiliating, but of course, he's the predator, not the victim, right? Mm-hmm. He received like countless terrorizing, basically, emails from this person who is pretty unhinged. And it really impacted his life, as he explained in his own book. He felt like this sort of shame had descended over him, like that he went into work, his colleagues were emailed by this person and accusing him of raping his students. And he felt like he couldn't show his face at work, right? That they would look at him as if he were a sexual predator. It had a profound impact on his ability to do his job and his sense of personal safety.
Right.
And so you're right, you don't hear about it as often, and in part because, you know, just statistically speaking, you know, women are 70% of victims of cyberstalking. Mm. So it doesn't mean, so they're 30% of men. And the story often lines up similar to women's in that it is sexually humiliating, and so men are often reduced to being and humiliated as if they're gay. You know what I mean? Like, so it turns people into gay men and then humiliates them on that basis, like uses very bigoted words. And it's terrorizing because it's suggested that people are interested in anal rape, which can inspire strangers to contact them, just as it does for female victims. We don't hear it as often, you're right, but we should.
And it's a topic, quite frankly, that could be an entire show, and I've had shows on this topic of the experience that women have not only using technology but interfacing and communicating with others with technology, and it is starkly apparent that the experience is quite different at all levels, and worthy of much more study. So we're getting to the portion of the show which Danielle, as a listener, you know, I call the unfair portion of the show. And it's always unfair because I get to, oftentimes at the end, I get to the, so what do we do question. So I have two, I want my last question ultimately is going to be, tell us about your policy proposal. But before we get there, I do want to come back to what we talked about briefly at the beginning, which is the role of these platforms and these private entities to deal with this issue, because we spent the bulk of the discussion talking about the law. So I mentioned in my introduction Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, and I was thinking, in terms of framing this, particularly for non-lawyers who listen, one of the early cases that I know you're familiar with involving defamation and harms online involving speech was a case called Zoran v. AOL, and I know you know the case well, and for listeners, this was a case involving an individual named Ken Zoran who was pranked by a variety of posts made on an AOL chat room listserv board, and again, this is an old case, so we're going into the late 90s, where a person who was never identified impersonated Zoran and indicated that Zoran was selling T-shirts that were making fun of and really saying awful things about the Oklahoma City Murrah Building bombing. And to make a long story short, and this was really horrific stuff, speaking of harm, so these posts went out there, a radio station picked up on it, and Zoran's business ultimately went out of business. He was threatened, he lost his job, he lost his livelihood, and harms down the line. from a platform perspective, AOL basically did nothing about it. And Section 230 became an issue because while AOL could certainly theoretically be held liable for not having done anything and for providing a outlet for this kind of pranking, and I know that that's really putting it nicely, Section 230 provides that these platforms are effectively, and there are some exceptions to it, shielded from cases like defamation, right? So long as they aren't actually the speaker. So if they're merely hosting the speech as opposed to actually saying something themselves. All that's by way of saying Section 230, I think, by many measures, has been viewed as a success in terms of being a spur for the creation of online platforms. But I know that you have a very different view, at least with regard to these issues, about how wonderful or how helpful Section 230 has been. So what's your view on Section 230? And I think it ties into this question of what you think online platforms should be doing that they are not to address these issues.
Right. So I guess my sense of my own view is that it's very measured, right? I agree that Section 230 has done lots of good things. I don't think we would have the Yelps and the Twitters of today, right, if we didn't have Section 230, nor Google, frankly, if you're going to have liability based on a distributor model, right? Or that you wouldn't have the sort of vibrant sort of speech marketplace that we have online without Section 230. But at the same time, I think it's important to remember that what spurred these very conservative Republican senators and congressmen who created this law in 1996 was that they would reward good Samaritans, which is what the subtitle of the section of the Communications Decency Act so provides. Mm-hmm. Like good Samaritans that tried to block offensive or harassing material would be rewarded with immunity, right? But what we've seen is not just, of course, good Samaritans who engage in some monitoring, but really all platforms, ISPs, and search engines enjoy this immunity because the statute doesn't distinguish between them, and I think rightfully doesn't. But what has happened is it's not just that we have this sort of blanket immunity. It's in some respects that immunity has been made a mockery of by site operators whose entire business model is destruction, is tort, are to engage into torts and crimes and to encourage other people to do so, right? And so where I would amend very narrowly Section 230 is to try to get the best out of Section 230 and limit its least, I think, effective zones, right? So when you immunize a revenge porn operator from liability, they're making money off of, you know, this business model essentially of extortion often. They don't certainly need the concern about, you know, immunizing them from liability because truthfully, even if they knew, which they do know, and are asked to take down content, they're never going to take it down, right? We're not really so worried about the kind of chilling we worry about when we have distributor liability for the ordinary site like the search engine, the Reddits of the world that have a lot of good speech along with some destructive speech, right? But they're going to cut their losses. A site like Reddit is going to cut its losses and just take down all complained about speech. So I think having a distributor model, like having liability, if you know or should know about speech and then don't, if you don't take it down, you should have liability. I think that's too far, right? It's too, it will put at risk and chill too much speech. But sites that truly need no, you know, nothing that you do will prevent them from engaging in destruction because they make money off of it. They shouldn't enjoy liability, right? And so I propose a very narrow carve out of Section 230, which would say that sites that knowingly and primarily host cyberstalking content, which I borrowed the definition from the federal cyberstalking law, they shouldn't enjoy immunity. And sites that know and encourage and primarily host non-consensual pornography defined in the way that I define it in the book, they shouldn't enjoy that immunity either, mm-hmm. right? But it is not, you know, the adoption or calling for Congress, which should it ever do anything like pass a budget and turn to this issue, right? I think it's just bullish to try to even think about this issue from the perspective of Congress. But nonetheless, I offer the proposal to be kind of ready to hand once and if they ever do. But it's really meant to be very narrow. because I want the best that I think Section 230 affords us. I want to get the best out of the internet and avoid the worst.
And it's an interesting point. I could imagine some of the pushback, and you know, you always run this risk when you have policy proposals, is people say, well, slippery slope, because right. It opens up doors in whatever my particular area of interest is. So, you know, obviously on Hearsay Culture, and you know, we talk a lot about copyright. So is there a functional difference between that narrow carve out and really the basis for it, the notion that these entities are making money off of hosting this content, and a criticism that's been leveled at entities like YouTube for a number of years now involving hosting copyright infringing works, and the argument's been YouTube should be liable for this, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds of the law, but they would be direct infringers of copyright in part by virtue of the fact that they are selling advertising around content that they know or have reason to believe is not authorized. Is that a fair parallel to draw, or are they different situations?
Actually, I would just distinguish it. I use the copyright DMCA notice and takedown as something to stay far away from. The distributor kind of model that, as you know, and you don't do it, you know or should know, that's distributor liability. And I stayed away from it because we see an over or too much collateral censorship of speech, right? I mean, on any given week, you see millions of requests, copyright requests, right, to take down speech. And I would imagine that all of it is legitimate. And that's why I reject a distributor liability model, right? People often say, oh, Section 230, forget it. You know, how we can fix the problem is to resort to a DMCA kind of notice and takedown regime. And I reject that idea, right? I think we're going to see far too much collateral censorship of really, I think it could be offensive, but nonetheless important speech, right? And I think we've got to be much more targeted, much more narrow about the way in which, if we're going to monkey with 230, we've got to be really careful.
And so I think that brings us back to the point you had mentioned earlier, which is that you're not as concerned about federal law as you are about changing state law and perhaps using federal law as a model. So you go to, you know, some length in this wonderful book, Danielle, talking about your reform proposal. Again, unfair portion of the show, because I'm going to ask you to summarize your reform proposal in literally about 2 minutes. So what would Danielle Citron have state legislatures do to address these problems?
Okay, so let's say there are three modes of attack, right? Civil law, criminal law, and civil rights law. Okay, so civil law, why don't we use it often? It's just too expensive, and also it's really hard for victims to sue if they have to sue in their real name. So one part of the proposals is to change the presumption against pseudonymity for plaintiffs in cases involving cyberstalking harassment. I can't solve the money problem. It's so expensive to sue. But nonetheless, I think it's one way to prop up the civil system. Criminal law, focusing on reforming and updating harassment and stalking laws and criminalizing revenge porn. We have a ways to go with civil rights law, right? So much of this abuse is what it does and says is fundamentally discrimination, right? So when people targeted Anita Sarkeesian, what did they really know about her except she was a woman who dared to write about sexism in video games? But except for California, state civil rights laws only cover bias intimidation that's directed at you because of race or national origin. We need to fix those laws, right? I also think we can think about changes vis-a-vis employers because so much of the abuse falls on victims because they can't get jobs, because their online reputations are destroyed. And I think there are ways in which we can have employers at least give notice to people. It's very much the tech due process, process stuff that I know you know, Dave, in my work. But having an opportunity to tell future employees about that their search results are being used against them and give them a chance to explain themselves. So that's my 2 minute version. How's that?
That was great. It's wonderful.
I don't know. 2 minutes. I tried.
No, I'm timing you down to the second, Danielle, and because I have Audacity running here, and that was about 2 minutes. Look, you know, again, Professor Danielle Citron, University of Maryland School of Law, author of the book Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, which was published by Harvard University Press last year. I'd love to say, you know, problem solved. I know you would as well. Unfortunately, I think your work moves us heavily in the direction of dealing with it. I think more than anything else, I'm having done a few talks on my own at the local level on these issues, that there is an enormous amount of simple education that needs to be done, and therefore I commend your book to those that want to learn more. Meanwhile, as always, I invite you back on the show to continue this discussion, and I thank you so much for joining us today on the show to educate our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me back. I really appreciate it, Dave.
So this quarter begins, and I'm very excited to mention that by the time that this show airs, Hearsay Culture will have a new website. I'm going to say more about it because I'm recording on April 2nd, and so I am both finalizing the schedule for the spring and also finalizing the website. So I'm going to say more about it probably in the next show that I record, but suffice to say that by the time the show is on the air, you should see a spanking new redesigned website done by two individuals who I'm going to name at that time and really do them justice through the best I can do, which is thanks. But meanwhile, I want to remind you that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU. As I'm recording today, I do not know when it will be on in the spring, but I know this much. You can always get the show by going to the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, the Stanford Cyber Law page. You can also go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 230-plus prior shows, as well as the upcoming schedule. And these guests, who I'm finalizing now, starting, of course, with Danielle Citron, I'm very excited about having on the show. So the last thing I will say, since the website, as you're listening to this, is new, please play around with the website and tell me what you like and what you don't. I have attempted to incorporate in this site a number of suggestions I've gotten about what the site should be doing, and these are suggestions that have gone back a number of years. But this site continues to be one that I can improve, and so if there's something that you would like to see that isn't there, or something that's there that isn't working, or anything else, please email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So, thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.